Blog Talk Radio.
Live every Wednesday, your Voice of Indie hosts, Beam Weeks and Stephen G, welcome authors, musicians, publishing industry pros, artists, and assorted creative guests for an exciting interactive hour. Call in during the show or post questions and comments on Twitter for responses in real time. Meet your favorite indie creators. Learn inside tips, network, and promote your work. At Voice of Indie, you can spend time with guests such as Country Music Hall of Fame drummer Mark Herndon, sci-fi master Robert G. Wilscroft, med expert Dr. Helen Burrell, the Tippins of Rocker's Wide Track, sports writer and photographer Stephen Hargis, broadcaster and author David Carroll, and international author Sally Cronin. The link for each week's show is pinned on Twitter atop at Voice of Indie, and you can receive the link every Wednesday morning in your inbox by subscribing to our newsletter at freshinkgroup.com. Check out Voice of Indie every Wednesday on Blog Talk Radio and catch hundreds of episodes archived everywhere from our website to our YouTube channel and Spotify.
Time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Gies, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
All right. Happy hump day, everybody. Good evening to one and all, or afternoon, depending on where you're at. Welcome to the Voice of Indie podcast. Show number 112. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me is Mr. Stephen G. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
Hey, I'm just thrilled to be here, and how about you?
I can't complain about anything, really. We've had some warm weather, some cooler weather, some warm weather again, and we're looking at some cool weather, and it's looking like fall is closing in on us. But other than that, I can't complain. Fall is okay. But it means cold and snow and like that. But I'll take the fall right now.
Yeah, how about you? You get to see beautiful fall colors up there. When I lived in Michigan, yeah. I used to love to drive up north into the forests in the fall and just see all that. Down here, we go from green to brown. It's if there's colors, it lasts for about 15 minutes, and it gets too hot. Like this week, we're going to be in the upper 90s. So enjoy your fall colors.
I will. All right. Listen, everybody, you know the routine. We've got a guest on tonight. If you have questions or comments for tonight's guest, you can call or use Twitter, and here's how you do that.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest, or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet, and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
Hey, hey. So here's an update on books that have come out in the last week or two or about to. Submariner, 30 Years of Hijinks, is 2 weeks out now. I believe it's approximately 2 weeks out now, and it's been riding the bestseller list, doing very well at Amazon and other retailers. And doing very well in print, too. We're going to learn about that in a couple of minutes. But Submariner by retired Naval Lieutenant Commander Jerry Pate, with a little bit of help from Robert G. Willis-Croft. He is out there. It's available in all editions. You can get a hardcover, beautiful hardcover with color interior, dust jacketed version. The soft cover has a color interior. And then we got the ebook edition. That's all in color as well. And everything's out there. It's just we can't seem to get Jerry's picture up on Amazon, but we think that's going to happen Friday. Anybody who wants to put some money in the betting pool, let me know. But that's what's going on with Submariner. Water Lilies Over My Grave by Patricia A. Guthrie.
Going to be released
on the 29th. It is in pre-sale right now. Get out there and order your hardcover. Order your soft cover. Order several digital copies for yourself, and then you'll have plenty of Water Lilies Over My Grave by Patricia A. Guthrie. We also have the How to Start and Run a Food Truck Business in Georgia book is out this week. The digital edition is out there right now. The soft cover and hard cover should start populating in the next day or two, and you can get out there and order your copies of that as well. That will go into pre-sale probably for about a month before the actual release date. So what's going on with promoting these things, Bean?
And did you know that we have book trailers for each of these three releases? They are over on YouTube. Yeah, go to YouTube, type in Fresh Ink Group, and visit our YouTube channel, and be sure to subscribe and like when you're over there. Hit the thumbs up on all those videos. All three of those have videos, book trailers. The Florida truck video is out right now. It's up there right now. You can go check it out. But the Georgia book and the series trailer, and which will also cover the website, those we are working on right now. And speaking of the food truck website, listeners, if you're out there and you stop to get a bite to eat at a food truck and it's something that you like that food, whatever it is, because there's all kinds of food trucks, snap a picture of that food truck or a couple of pictures and send them to us, info@freshinkgroup.com, and we will put those on this website, and we will maybe even add them to our newsletter. And speaking of our newsletter, if you want to keep up to date with what's going on in the world of publishing, indie publishing, fresh authors, this podcast, here's how you can subscribe to our newsletter.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Ink Group with our weekly digital newsletter, new releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
What?
Hey, so a couple of days ago when we worked on this rundown, I went and checked to see how the print sales were going, see what our top five bestsellers were at the time. And then I checked again right before the podcast. There was a little bit of a shift, but in both cases, the top two items on the list were the same book, hardcover and softcover, Submariner, 30 Years of Hijinks and Keeping the Fleet Afloat, by retired Naval Lieutenant Commander Jerry Pate with Robert G. Willis Croft. That's 60 chapters of true life stories about working the seas, working under the seas, and you know, the whole submariner life, and some of the missions that Jerry worked on, and some of the hijinks that happened as well. Great book. It's getting great support, a lot of interest, and five-star reviews are starting to pop up, so we're real pleased with that. Submariner, 30 Years of Hijinks and Keeping the Fleet Afloat, is our number one bestseller in hardcover. It's our number two bestseller in softcover.
Wow.
Now, both lists had the same number three item. Still not enough. Minority Millennials in the Workforce by Janelle A. Jordan. That's a look at, well, it kind of speaks for itself, what's going on with the workforce these days with minority millennials. Excellent book, and she's getting a great reception, and it's moving very well out there. So that's still not enough. Minority Millennials in the Workforce. Now, here's where we get the slight divergence. No, not yet. The fourth slot is Practical Problems, 10 Stories for the Stage by Jay Ash Looney. He was our guest on the show 2 or 3 weeks ago. If you missed it, check the archives because it's there and you can listen to it. If you already listened to it, but it's one of your all-time favorite shows, go listen to it again. It's still in the archives. But that's Practical Problems, 10 Stories for the Stage is in the number four slot. That's the hardcover. Now, when I checked 2 days ago, the softcover had the number fifth slot. So Practical Problems held fourth and fifth. But in the meantime, number five dropped off a little bit, and I'll bet you never guess what sneaked into the number five slot, Dean.
I don't know. I'm guessing maybe Practical Problems, the other edition?
Well, no, because I just said that one just dropped out. This is what slipped into its slot.
Well, this is what I got the list that you sent me earlier, and it's still
the high
there.
Road.
It hasn't changed.
The High Road.
The High Road.
The High Road.
Mark
Memories
Herndon.
From a Long Trip by Mark Herndon. Country Music Hall of Fame drummer, played with the band Alabama for almost three decades until they kind of squeezed him out. And then file a lawsuit against him, too. But if you want to learn all about that, it's in the book. It's a great memoir. Boy, you want to know what life is like, achieving your dream, playing to sold-out arenas around the world, living the life. Mark tells the story. So that's congratulations, Mark. That sneaked back into our number five slot this week.
Yeah, and Stephen just a minute ago had mentioned the archive. So you got a favorite episode you want to hear? Or you just want to peruse our previous episodes, and find a guest that you didn't know we had, well, here's your chance to do that. This is how you can find us in the archives.
If you miss a show, find us in the archives in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, on Spotify, or under the podcast tab at freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. On YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe.
Now, we are also on iHeartRadio and TuneIn and Google Podcasts. We go to those places, just type in at the search for The Voice of Indy, all one word, The Voice of Indy. And you can find all of our archived selections over there. And this is an archive that's going to be growing even bigger. So get to that newsletter. Subscribe.
Yeah, that
to
newsletter. Today's newsletter has all of the links. Today's newsletter has all the links for our archive places. We're going to put that in there again next week as well.
All right, we're going to introduce our guest now. Larry Jorgensen first became fascinated with Michigan's Upper Peninsula and its unique history while writing and reporting for television in Green Bay. However, his journey into that world of news had begun much earlier in northern Wisconsin, where he worked while in high school for the weekly newspaper in Eagle River. Later, he was employed by a newspaper publisher in Milwaukee, and then on to radio and television news in Texas and Louisiana, along with wire and freelance assignments. During all those years, he looked forward to a return visit to the Keweenaw Peninsula. It was during one of those visits Larry discovered the tale of the wreck of the city of Bangor. It was learning of that little-known event which resulted in his decision to create his written account, which he hoped would share the story of one of Lake Superior's most unusual shipwrecks. Welcome to the show, Larry Jorgensen.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to share my story one more time, because it's an absolutely fascinating story.
Well, we will
definitely.
We will be definitely delving into that. So we see here in your bio that you've been to many different places where you've lived. Where are you living these days?
Well, I actually live in Louisiana, central Louisiana, town called Marksville, which is not far from Alexandria. I guess that's our biggest area. And we're in the center of the state. So we get a little bit of a buffer before those nasty storms come ashore. And it's a beautiful place to live. We're on a beautiful little bayou and nice and quiet, a good place to write books and do research.
Right.
So over on Twitter, Verwayne Greenhost, curious about where you live in Wisconsin as well. He says, I read this morning in this morning's email that Mr. Jorgensen lived in Wisconsin. I'm curious if he had family in my home county of Montcalm. One of the biggest family-owned grocery chains in Michigan is Jorgensen's, home of the annual Danish Festival held in Greenville every August. I hear some chuckling coming from Mr. Jorgensen.
No, I mean, I appreciate the attempt to place me with a family of such great significance, but I'm not related to them. But I think the only relatives that I've got here were good old northern Wisconsin resort owners and outdoorsmen. In fact, my grandfather was the number two guide when they started licensing fishing guides in Wisconsin. He got the number two badge. I'm not sure who got number one, but our family goes back to pioneering hunting, fishing, resorts, that type of thing in the north woods of Wisconsin.
Wow. It gets a little bit cold up there too. So
not near as cold as the Upper Peninsula, though.
Oh, yeah. I've been there many times. We got a few more comments on Twitter. Let's knock them out, too. Robert Willis Croft pointed out that Submariner, the soft cover edition, is black and white interior. So if you want color pictures, you have to buy the hardcover. And then in order to get the cost down on the soft cover for people who just wanted the black and white pictures, you can do it that way. I was working on three books today, and all three of them were doing color interiors and the soft covers, too. So color interiors is becoming more and more popular lately, it seems. But at any rate, Yeah, Joe Conjul says, hello, Voice of Indy. Looking forward to hearing Larry Jorgensen's story. And then he says, hi, Larry. I've been to the World of Coke in Atlanta. Yeah, I think we pretty much all have, haven't we? And I'm intrigued by your book, The Coca-Cola Trail. What about that story? Piqued your interest enough to write the book?
Well, The Coca-Cola Trail is, in fact, what it says. It's a story about people and places in the history of Coca-Cola, and it's people and places all over the country. It's not about Atlanta. In fact, it's about the people who actually started bottling the Coca-Cola beverage before Coca-Cola did. And it's what we've done with the book is we've tracked down these places where you can still go today and see Coca-Cola history, whether it's an old bottling plant or some other piece of Coca-Cola history. And while you're there, we're going to reveal all the details along with old photos of what you're looking at. So it's travel and it's history about Coca-Cola throughout the United States.
And there are two books in that series now, right?
Right. We had such great response on the original book that we did a second book called Return to the Coca-Cola Trail. And that actually started as a result of readers of the first book who would contact me and they would say, well, you forgot about. So I started a file of forgot abouts. And the next thing I know, I've got enough for another book. And
that's
I'm
a great
sure
one.
There's
They do the research for you.
Yeah, they gave me the places to look, that's for sure. And once you start looking, Coca-Cola is so well known that you find people that will talk about it all over the country.
Yeah,
I'm kind of curious because, you know, like Coca-Cola had started, you know, originally as a fountain drink, and you said that other people started bottling it even before Coca-Cola did. I find that kind of interesting that Coke, basically the headquarters, didn't jump on that first.
Well, in fact, Coca-Cola, the gentleman who owned Coca-Cola at that time, Asa Candler, was interested in producing the syrup to make Coca-Cola to be sold at soda fountains.
Yeah, at fountains.
And it was actually 4 to 5 years that one little soda fountain owner in Vicksburg, Mississippi, was bottling Coca-Cola. And he did tell Coke that he was doing this, and they just sort of let him do it and ignored him because he also was kind of a distributor for the syrup. But about 5 years later, two ambitious young attorneys from Chattanooga went to Atlanta, talked to Mr. Candler, and sought the exclusive agreement to bottle Coca-Cola all over the United States. Well, he told them that was, and this is his words, he said, that's a dumb idea. He said, bottling Coca-Cola, why, that's a backstreet operation. And he discouraged them to the point where they kept at him, and finally, after a couple days, he said, all right, your attorneys, go back to your hotel tonight and draw up a contract as to what this would be. So they did. The next day, they went to Asa and they said, here's our contract. We want to have exclusive bottling rights throughout the United States. And I think just to get rid of them, he said, all right, I'm going to sell you the rights, except in Mississippi, because it's already being done there. But he said, I'll sell you the rights to exclusively bottle Coca-Cola for $1. And
wow,
it said he never even bothered to collect a dollar. And as they left, he told them, if this doesn't work, don't come crying back to me about it. So he had no faith. He had no faith in bottling Coca-Cola. And from there is really how the story takes off, because the two entrepreneurs, as they were from Chattanooga, go back to Chattanooga with these rights to bottle throughout the United States. Well, between the two of them, they've got $1,500.
Yeah.
And they start a little bitty bottling operation, and they say, no, this is not going to work. And then, you know, today we call it franchising. Well, the light went on. They said, wait a minute. We will sell pieces of what we own. We'll sell territories. And so if you wanted to bottle Coca-Cola in Paducah, Kentucky, they would sell you a 50-mile area in Paducah. And you became the Coca-Cola bottler for Paducah, Kentucky. Now, part of the contract, these were pretty clever lawyers, because part of the contract after they sold you the territory for, you know, $1,500, $2,000, you had to use Coca-Cola syrup. Makes sense. Everybody wants to have the same type of Coca-Cola. But when you bought your Coca-Cola syrup from Atlanta, the guys who sold you the territory got a commission on every gallon of syrup you bought. So they were gone, but not forgotten.
Wow.
That's fascinating. We're going to jump over here on Twitter real quick. Verwayne Greenhoe, he's been working this Vela platform for a while, and he's got another little update. He says, I've been playing with the Vela platform for the last 3 months. I've noticed how to increase my income based on how often I post an episode and how often I post here. Shorter and more frequent posts pay more than wordier, less frequent posts. Interesting. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, Marlena Smith-Burris has posted, I love the idea of the Coca-Cola Trail. Such a neat concept for a book. Also, I've never been to the Atlanta Center. Laugh out loud. Well, when you're ready to go, Marlena, let me know. My favorite thing in there is they've got this big, massive room. And when you think of Coca-Cola, you think of the flavor Coca-Cola. But Coca-Cola bottles, you know, Fanta, and I mean, all kinds of flavors and stuff. And they have different flavors in different countries of the world. So you go in this giant room and there's kiosks. There's like 100-something kiosks representing different countries. And on that kiosk, it's soda fountains, and it gives you all the flavors that they sell in that country. And it's some weird stuff, you know, cactus,
yeah,
whatever, things like that. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, you better know where the bathroom is if you're going to spend all afternoon walking around tasting flavors. But
tasting flavors.
Pretty cool. Taste and flavors. It's pretty cool.
Now, Joe Conjo, he's got a quick little question. He says, will you ever do the Pepsi Cola Trail? Joe,
yeah,
nobody cares about Pepsi.
I do.
Well, you know, Pepsi Cola went through a lot of transitions, and it didn't really ever have the magnetism, I guess you'd call it, of Coca-Cola. So many interesting people got involved in the early years of Coca-Cola and have stuck with it today. There are fourth and fifth generation families that are still bottling, distributing Coca-Cola. And they're the ones that really have made the book because of the stories and the photos and the things they were able to tell me about the history of Coca-Cola. Pepsi's been around a long time, but it doesn't have that magic history to it that Coca-Cola has.
Yeah, I've always thought the history of Mountain Dew would be interesting because it originated in the South, and you know, it was a niche little product and stuff, and it grew and changed and evolved. And then when Pepsi bought it, they turned it into marketing genius. To this day, Mountain Dew marketing still amazes me at all the different angles and ways that they play it. Right now I'm sitting here drinking Voodoo. D-E-W, for Halloween edition, you know,
right.
So they've always got an angle.
Well, 20-odd years ago when I used to drink soda pop, I don't drink it hardly at all anymore, Mountain Dew was always my favorite back then. I never liked Pepsi. Coke was okay, you know, but Mountain Dew was it for me.
So let's play a couple of commercials here, Beam. Why don't we do bang two in a row here and get back to asking Larry about his next book.
Okay, and I see we do have a caller just popped up, so we'll get that caller when we get done with these commercials.
Cool.
All right.
Psychologist Annabelle O'Brien flees from her psychotic ex-husband in New York City, only to find he is stalking her across the country with deadly intentions. She takes a job in the resort town of Lake Nage. When a series of attacks place her in even greater danger, Annabelle turns to hostile burnout of a detective, Mark Driscoll, who is assigned to protect her. Then, two women who resemble her are murdered, and the town is gripped with fear. Mark and Annabelle must work together to catch the killer before he catches them. From the celebrated author of such bestsellers as Legacy of Danger and her collection Eerie Charms of the Short Story, Water Lilies Over My Grave is a novel of psychological suspense about one woman searching for a new life, even as she is threatened by her old one. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, Water Lilies Over My Grave is available in all print and digital formats worldwide. Discover Practical Problems, 10 Stories for the Stage by Jay Ashlooney. In Goin' Legit, mobsters seek a conventional bank loan with hilarious results. In The Angry Ashtray, an inanimate object comes to life and has a surprising view about familiarity. In Blues Man Brando, actor Marlon Brando pays a surprising and surreal visit to a suburban family. In Up From the Ashes, a local historical society decides to turn back the clock, way back. In A Hard Way's Night, an aging rock band regroups to bid goodbye to the grungy ballroom where they got their start. And in The Three Christs of Ypsilanti, based entirely upon a true story, three psychotics attempt to convince a psychologist they are each the son of God. There are four more stories too delicious to summarize by Jay Ashlooney and published proudly by Fresh Ink Group in soft, hard, and all digital formats. Practical Problems delivers what it promises.
On Twitter, for Wayne Greenho says, they say everyone has to believe in something. I believe I'll have another Coke.
There you go.
There you go, for Wayne. Pour it over ice. So we got a couple of callers, huh?
We do. One of them is Dr. Helen. So we're going to go ahead and talk to Helen first and check in and see how she's doing. And go for hello, Dr. Helen. How are you doing tonight?
Hi. Well, things are tough. You should come here and write a book about this.
Well, Helen,
I'm a roommate with a crazy lady, so that's a whole other story.
Still the same crazy lady?
I missed the first half of your thing, but I'm going to listen to the rest. And whoever is on, I hope they will.
We talked a little Coca-Cola history, opening the show up. Really fascinating history.
Oh,
you want to go back and listen to the archive.
Who's ever, are you talking with a writer?
Larry Jorgensen.
I always want to know about that process.
Yeah,
Larry
okay.
Jorgensen, all right.
We're going to ask him about that. Helen, the phone number we've been trying to call you at is not working for us, so we need for you to call one of us again. And we're gonna move on to our next caller now because we got more questions and stuff. But listen in. This is Larry Jorgensen, Helen, and he's got some fascinating stories.
Okay, I will. I'm listening.
All right.
Take
thanks,
care.
Helen. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. Good luck.
Okay. All right. And now we're going to go to our other caller. And this is the caller with the area code 256. Welcome to the show, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, guys. This is B.A. Johnson calling from Huntsville, Alabama.
Hey.
Hi, B.A. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hi, thanks. I have a question. I live in Huntsville. I hope that Mr. Jorgensen included the bottling plant that was here in Huntsville a long time ago.
Well, if it's not still there, we didn't include it because what we want are plants or buildings or whatever that are still there that people can go touch, feel, see, and then have an opportunity to learn about. So I don't recall the history of the Huntsville plant. We did write about a lot of Alabama plants, but I don't think we wrote about Huntsville.
Well, that's unfortunate because there was one here in Huntsville, and kids in elementary school always went on a tour of that plant. But yes, it has been demolished, and we've lost that history, so that's unfortunate as well. But yes, we did have a Coca-Cola bottling plant here, and there were glass windows on the front, and you could see the sodas being placed in the bottles on these conveyor belts day and night. So that's part of our history that we've lost.
Well, that's kind of Coca-Cola's plan for building their plants. They would always have that big window, and many times if, you know, the neighborhood boys were standing there looking at the Cokes go by, one of the workers might grab a couple bottles off the line and take them outside to them. I've had a lot of that type of stories told to me, but that was their trademark. A big window, you come watch us bottle Coca-Cola, because then you'll know that we're bottling the best.
Yeah, there you go.
Yes, that's true. That's very true. So we enjoyed it while it was here, and now it's gone, and all we have are memories.
I think just this past week or two, they announced that there's some new development going to go in where the old Coca-Cola plant used to be in Huntsville.
That is true.
Now, we've got a posting from Lauren Smith. She says, it's good to hear Helen. She sounds like she's getting stronger. Barbara Johnson has a point. She says there was a bottling plant located in Huntsville. Lauren Smith's in Scottsboro, Alabama. She says there's something Coca-Cola related right here in Scottsboro, too. I can't think of what that is. But
What town was that?
Scottsboro.
What town was
Scottsboro.
Scottsboro. No, yeah. That one got away from us, too. I'm not sure about that one.
Okay. You see, VA has dropped.
Thanks for calling, Barbara.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Barbara. We had a, bringing up old Coca-Cola bottling plants, we had one here in Lansing, Michigan. It was back in the 70s when I was a kid. It was a hop-in place, but by the end of the 70s, early 80s, it closed down. And the last time I was out on that side of town, the building was still there, but it was abandoned. So I don't know if they've done something with it. It's been a few years since I've been out there.
That's the problem. There's a lot of abandoned Coca-Cola buildings and Coca-Cola signs and so forth. And it takes a community to say, wait a minute, that's a piece of our history. Let's do something with that. You know, in Albion, Michigan, they actually spent over $50,000. It was a combination of state money and locally raised donations to restore a large Coca-Cola mural that was over the Kalamazoo River. And they did a wonderful job on it, but it cost a lot of money because the building was about to fall into the river. So first of all, they had to reinforce the wall on the building, and then they went to a lot of effort to restore that mural back to its original content. You know, and I asked, there are a lot of stories like that in my book, and I asked one time, I said, why do you spend these thousands of dollars to simply restore a piece of advertising? And I was like, shame on you. That's not advertising. That's our history. That's a part of our town. And when we look at that sign, that brings back memories of things that happened at that time. And, of course, we're going to save it as best we can. And it happens all over the country, and we've got a lot of that in the book.
That's some of the most collectible stuff there is, too. Memorabilia like Coca-Cola signs, the old Coca-Cola coolers, the little refrigerators you see in the country stores, all that stuff. People want that. And they're willing to pay for it.
There's a huge organization of Coca-Cola memorabilia collectors, and not only throughout the United States, but throughout the world. They're in Japan, they're, you know, Australia, and this past July, they had their annual convention in Green Bay, Wisconsin this year, and all these collectors from all over the country will show up and they'll swap items, they'll put items up for sale, and of course they're looking for that elusive piece that they need for their particular collection. So it is, in fact, when the book first came out, it was the Coca-Cola collectors that really gravitated to it immediately.
Oh, that, yeah.
Yeah, I do a lot of garage selling during the summertime, and I see a lot of Coca-Cola memorabilia there. Not necessarily for sale. They're like somebody will put a man cave in their garage, and they'll have like some of these
right.
old antique Coca-Cola advertisements and the signs and whatnot up on the walls, and some of that stuff is worth a lot of money.
It really is. Along with you mentioned those vending machines. There's certain models that they only made a few of, and those machines are worth thousands of dollars.
Yeah. So, Larry, you're a journalist. You've got a strong journalistic background, and you're kind of semi-retired from that now, but you still do a lot of side work and whatnot with your clients. What kind of stuff are you involved in?
Well, basically, you know, being in Louisiana, of course, lots of good food and lots of interesting products come out of Louisiana. And I do some media work for several companies down there. But one of them, I imagine a lot of your listeners are familiar with, the Tony Sachery Company. And their number one product, of course, is their famous Creole seasoning. It comes in that little green can with the funny looking chef on it, you know. But I've been doing media work for them for probably 14, 15 years. They're a great family owned Louisiana company that has grown throughout the United States, and they have a lot of products besides the seasoning. But my main job is to, they call me the freebie guy. I don't buy media. I attempt to get free media. Like, for example, we'll get the chef on TV, things like that. So that's one of the things I do. And also I'm involved with a statewide radio network in Louisiana. So it's enough to keep me active when I'm not writing books, but my joy right now is new books, and I've got one that's recently came out, and another one is already in the works.
Yeah, we're going to talk about those in a minute, too. Right now, we need to knock out another commercial, and then when we come back, we're going to ask you about racing snowmobiles.
Mm.
Okay. Yeah.
Submariner, 30 years of hijinks and keeping the fleet afloat. Jerry Pate's semi-autobiographical collection of 60 stories recounts his 30 years in and around the U.S. Navy submarine fleet, ranging from lighthearted to wrenching. All are poignant inside looks at naval operations rarely seen by outsiders. Topics include the real story behind the shuttle Challenger tragedy, risking his own life underwater, discovering a Soviet spy living across the street, surviving when an engine ignites, critical missions, and the everyday lives of men and women of the fleet. Compiled by author Robert G. Williscroft and proudly published by Fresh Ink Group, Submariner is available worldwide in hardcover, softcover, and all ebook formats. Dive into Submariner for hijinks and breathtaking adventure with this poignant memoir by a true American hero.
We're enjoying the fact that that book's getting so much attention, and it's bringing some attention to Jerry, which he long deserves. I mean, he had a great career. He retired, but he also suffered a serious accident and some disability from it, and has to struggle with some limitations now. And getting this book together, getting this out, was definitely a passion project for him and for us as well. And now he's starting to hear from people in the Navy and people who are submariners and people who understand what he's talking about. And that's terrific. It's good that a man can reach a point in his life where he gets some recognition for his accomplishment, some feedback from the people who appreciate what he's done. Congratulations, Jerry. It's a great book.
Yeah, congratulations,
glad to see it out there,
Jerry.
Performing.
Yeah, and you can find his episode in the archive. He was a really interesting guest to have on, and maybe
stories.
We can get him on again.
Yeah,
now, before
stories.
We move on, before we move on, Verwayne Greenhouse, touching back on the Coca-Cola memorabilia stuff, he says, as I clean the land around my place here in the armpit of Florida, he means the panhandle, we are finding a lot of old Coke bottles in green and blue glassware buried in the trees behind us. We've been washing and cleaning it up, and it will go into my writing room when it is finished. That's
cool.
Interesting that you bring that up, Verwayne, because my sister lives up in Farwell, Michigan, and where she lives, it's an RR grade, a railroad grade, where the tracks used to go through there back in the long ago days. They pulled the tracks up, and now it's a road, and they own a bunch of property up there. And at the end of that road, decades ago, you know, I'm talking 40s and 50s, people would dump their garbage there at the end of that road coming off of the railroad tracks. And she has found just a bunch of old Coca-Cola bottles out there from the 40s and the 50s. And she's cleaned a bunch of them up, and she's given some out as gifts and whatnot. But some really cool stuff out there. She found a bunch of other stuff as well, but the Coca-Cola bottles really stood out.
Yeah, for Wayne, maybe you could put them on eBay and claim that they were a cash that were buried by Ponce de Leon's man. And now they're worth a fortune.
How about a Coca-Cola bottle that was worth $150,000?
Is that the jewel-encrusted one?
No, what that was, you know, Coca-Cola, in the very early days of bottling, everybody was attempting to knock off the brand. You had Coca, you had cola with a K and so forth, and the bottling in those days was whatever bottle you could find to put the stuff in. So there was massive confusion from the consumer standpoint. They didn't know if they were buying Coca-Cola or whatever. Coca-Cola decided to have the bottle that would be the only bottle, and they had a competition amongst bottle manufacturers. And to try to make this story short, after the competition in 1905, one bottle was selected out of six that were submitted, and that is the bottle that we recognize today. Well, at that particular judging, the five that were not selected, and that each company brought five bottles, were destroyed. They were to be destroyed, as well as all but one of the winning bottle, and that one bottle went into Coca-Cola archives. Well, as it turned out, there was a second winning bottle that escaped and was held by a family for years. The family actually had participated in the design of the bottle. Well, about 2 years ago, the bottle came up for sale at an estate auction in California. And the reason we know it was that bottle, on the bottom it had the date 1905, and Coca-Cola didn't start using that bottle until 1906. And that, my friend, went for $150,000.
Wow.
Nice.
For a Coke
bottle. We used to pick them up for 2 cents, didn't we?
I'm still picturing that convention of collectors up that met in Wisconsin. You know, you got like 500 of these hardcore Coca-Cola collectors in a room, and somebody opens the door, and in wanders a guy with a Pepsi jacket. Man, that could get ugly. Whoa, that could get ugly.
He'd be in trouble. He would not have a. Anyone there would want to buy it, I can tell you that.
So, racing snowmobiles, Indy cars, what are you doing with your spare time here, Larry?
Well, I didn't race Indy cars, but yes, I did race snowmobiles. And this was back when snowmobiling really started to take off, back in 1969. And it was in the early 70s that I got addicted. I started, you know, just riding them, and fell in love with it. And then I decided I would get into racing snowmobiles. So about 1971-72, I was fortunate enough to be approached by the Pabst Brewing Company, good old PBR, who also wanted to make some inroads into the snowmobile crowd, and they had me put together a race team, a snowmobile race team for Pabst Blue Ribbon. And, of course, I got to be one of the team members as well as the organizer. And we literally raced all over the country. I mean, from New York to Montana, wherever, and raced in a lot of the big races. You know, and we had some I was not a great driver, I'll be honest, but I won a few. But we had some fantastic racers on our team, and every year we would place a couple of our drivers in the World Series of snowmobile racing. So it was a fun time. I raced enough that I enjoyed it. It was both oval racing and cross country. I think the biggest cross country race that I was in for 3 years, they used to race snowmobiles from Winnipeg, Canada to St. Paul, Minnesota. And that was the start of the St. Paul Winter Carnival. It was a 3-day race, and you started out at 40 machines at a time in Winnipeg, and you took off for St. Paul, and there were two overnight stops along the way. It was quite a race, and I know that one time we left Winnipeg, and it was like 30 below zero. I can remember thinking, I guess my brain is frozen. What am I doing out here? You know. So, but it was fun. It was all part of that. We, like I say, we raced everywhere. We had a great team, a lot of good guys that were a heck of a lot better than me, and a lot of great memories in snowmobile racing.
Wow. Yeah, I'd like to see some pictures from those days as well.
Yeah, I remember you said that, you know, that's 1969 when the racing took off. I remember a year later, 1970, we had a family up the road. It was my dad's second cousin, and they bought snowmobiles. That was the first time I ever rode a snowmobile. We didn't race them, but, man, those were a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was easy to get addicted to the sport.
Now, when we get feedback from our listeners, people who listen to the show live or people who listen to the show in the archives, and if you're not aware of the archives, we've got a whole bunch of links in today's newsletter, but people give us feedback on what kind of questions they like, and one of the most popular questions we ask, which you heard Dr. Helen mention today, is what she's interested in. What's your process like, Larry? What do you do? I mean, do you have certain goals, a certain place that you write? You only face east, you chant, you burn incense. What's going on with your process? And I'm betting, give the kind of books you write, research is probably a key element.
Research is very definitely, because I'm writing, you know, nonfiction, and I'll get interested in an item of history, and if you write from something you're interested in, I don't really schedule a time. I'll be thinking about it, and I'll think of an idea. I'll think, well, what about this? Let's check this out. So you research, and you find, first of all, you find time in your day to sit down before it gets away from you and start to rough out what that chapter will be. And then it just sort of flows, you know. I guess the best time for me, when I could get it, is in the morning. You get up in the morning, you get that first or second cup of coffee and a good shower, and it's amazing the ideas that seem to flow from coffee and a shower. So I'll try whenever I can to put a good dent in what I'm doing in the morning. Then your day takes over because I am involved in other things. So a lot of times I'll find myself scribbling notes during the day, and then when, you know, 5 o'clock whistle blows, as they say, I gather up my notes and back to my computer or whatever I'm working on that day, and try to put all those together. And little by little, you end up getting a book.
Now, your current book is Shipwrecked. How did you, what led to this interest in the shipwreck that led to the book?
Well, I was up in the Upper Peninsula, the very tip of the Keweenaw Peninsula, two summers ago. I get up there a lot because I love that country. And there's a lot of history.
Beautiful country up
there.
Yeah.
And I just saw a small article in one of these local handout magazines about this shipwreck. And the more I read about it, the more I realized there's never been anything like that ever on the Great Lakes. And I just, again, like the old news dog, I got a hold of a bone and I couldn't turn it loose. I started researching and talking to people, and next thing I know, I'm addicted to the story. And the thing that makes the whole thing really the only book of the only wreck of its time ever on the Great Lakes is the fact that that ship was carrying 240 brand new Chryslers. Now this
wow.
is brand new in 1925. Okay,
wow.
And the book tells how not only was the crew rescued, but so were the cars. The ship was basically totaled when a storm tossed it onto a reef off of Copper Harbor, Michigan. And the boat ended up there for 18 years. It was a total loss. And first we had to worry about the crew. The crew got ashore with a lifeboat and almost got lost. This is the end of November in the snow up there in the Keweenaw, and almost froze to death. It was just pure happenstance that a Coast Guard rescue boat found them before they were about ready to perish in the cold. So we get them rescued, and we tell the story of how they're rescued. But then 3 months later, you know, Mr. Walter Chrysler realizes he's got 240 brand-new Chryslers sitting on a boat on a reef in the middle of Lake Superior. He decides he wants his cars back, hires a company out of Duluth, a salvage company, and says, I'll pay you $140 a car if you can get them back here to Detroit. Well, the book goes on to tell how that was done, how they got them off the boat, they got them onto the reef, how they got them off of the reef and got them to shore, and then how they ultimately got them further down the peninsula to be loaded onto a train, which wasn't easy because they're not plowing the roads in 1925, and the snow up there is pretty darn deep. One little side story. There was one of the cars that didn't make it back to Detroit. A family ended up with it up there in the peninsula, and they had it for 60-some years, and we trace the history of that car and tell you where you can see it today. It is on display, and it has over 200,000 miles on it. So
wow.
The book has a lot of fascinating history. And it truly, you know, you say Lake Superior shipwreck, everybody says
Edmund Fitzgerald.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Well, the difference is we have finally a happy ending to our shipwreck story. The cars were saved, the crew was saved, and it's all, when you read the story, you realize it's all because of the effort of hundreds of people basically in this forlorn, at that time, Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I mean, we're talking about, if you look at the map, there's a little piece of Michigan that sticks out into Lake Superior, beautiful country, but there's not a lot of people living up there in 1925.
No. Oh.
Yeah.
And this is almost 30 years before the Mackinac Bridge was built, so that was isolated, totally isolated
yes,
up there.
Exactly,
you
yeah.
Could, I'm wondering
yeah,
how they got all those cars down to the Lower Peninsula. They had to put them on ferries or something.
So what they did, once they were able to, and it took a long time to get them off the boat and get them into the little town of Copper Harbor, but then it's 40 miles to the nearest railroad depot, which is in Calumet. And they finally were able to blast the road, the road open to Calumet, and one by one they drove these cars to Calumet and ultimately got them onto a train to be transported back to Detroit. And, of course, in those days, you could do this. You know, they touched them up a little bit and put them back out for sale. So Walter got most of his cars back. There were a few that did end up at the bottom of Lake Superior only because of a safety chain broke. And there was one that was badly demolished when it hit the reef. And that one was sold for $25 to a local car dealer for parts. But it's quite a story as to how they finally got most of them back to Detroit. And the other little secret on this thing, there were also six Whippets. Whippet was a car. It was made in Toledo for 3 years, and there were six Whippets on that ship. Well, we know that Walter Chrysler obviously didn't want to pay to have a competitive car brought back to Detroit. And we were able to track down at least two of the six, and there are pictures in the book, and we only have to presume that the other four probably ended up in a junkyard someplace. So,
wow.
And again, the boat sits on the reef, abandoned, you know, not demolished, but badly damaged for 18 years before they finally figure out how to get it off the reef and get the steel used for wartime, which we needed 18 years later.
Now, over on Twitter, Verwayne Greenhill, he's got some timely comments about that, about the UP and all that. He used to live up there, currently living in Florida, but he's a longtime resident of the UP. He said, I lived up in the UP for 7 years. I miss everything except the 350 inches of snow every year and the weeks of highs of 3 degrees. Other than that, I love it. Loved it and missed it. I was all over the Keweenaw. And he
That's 350
says,
inches a day?
He said every year. He also says the UP has always been sparsely populated. I always told my friends, the nice thing about the UP is there's nobody here. The bad thing about the UP is there's nobody here.
Yeah.
But there is so much history there. You get up into the UP and the history of the copper mining, and that is what originally took me to the UP as a reporter in Green Bay Television when they started to shut down the copper mines because of the strike, the workers' strike. That was my first assignment, was covering that series of stories in the Upper Peninsula. And I just became fascinated with the country, and it became a favorite snowmobile area for me in the winter. You know, it's just like the man said, in Florida, there's an awful lot of Upers that are now living in the South that miss the wonderful benefits of the Upper Peninsula when it's not quite so cold.
Yeah, there was in the 1800s, early 1900s, there were a lot of those copper mining camps, and then there were also the logging camps up there. And those are all gone now. I mean, you can still see the remnants of them, but they don't operate anymore.
You have in the Keweenaw, it's heavy copper mining, and there are some of the old mines that the Quincy is the big one up in Hancock, where you can actually tour the mine, go down. They have the elevator that takes you down, and so forth. And then you get more over into the Marquette area, and you've got a lot more of the iron mining that took place there. And there is still some mining being done, but primarily mines are a thing of history now in the Upper Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Verwayne Greenhoe added another comment on Twitter. He says, I would love to have a day or three with your guest. You know, Verwayne, the next best thing is book. Spend a day or three with his book.
<That's> right.
Got some stories and stuff.
Tell him, get the book and find my email, and we'll swap stories back and forth.
There you go. So, Bean, you want to run another commercial before we get into the wind down here?
Sure.
Let's do a Willis. Go ahead. You're good. No, go ahead. You're good.
Okay.
Four very different people find their very different lives intertwined as they put down roots in the city by the bay. Catherine is the withering transplant who learns to compromise her very soul for a budding career. Amanda reaches for the light with one man, while another shadows her with darkness. Matthew grows the reputation of immaculate university, but his secrets poison the very well sustaining too many people's words. Brad thrives on success in business and casual sex until love dares try to root in his heart. The vernal promise of springtime blazes in glorious color, even as hope and faith die. In the inevitable autumns, all must strive to survive. Greed, exploitation, hatred, and somehow love shape the everyday, but might possibly and hope somehow endure amid new beginnings. Proudly published by Fresh Ink Group Worldwide in softcover and all ebook editions, check out The Autumn Tree by Aisha Esson.
And there's a brand spanking new YouTube video for that book trailer, so get over to Fresh Ink Group on YouTube and check it out.
Like it, share it, and subscribe to the channel while you're there. Definitely.
Yes. Indeed.
So, Larry, you've been out promoting this book. You did like a tour across the Upper Peninsula in Wisconsin. Tell us briefly about that.
Right. We attended everything from a book signing at a university in Hancock to a variety of wonderful events. We went to some lighthouse events. We went to some good old Upper Peninsula events like Who Could Ever Forget the Pasty Fest in Calumet, you know, or we went to Ontonagon where they have the Great Copper Fest that is a tribute to the largest boulder of copper, pure copper, ever found, which I think is in the Smithsonian right now. But we went all over Upper Michigan, a lot more places we would like to have gone, but there's always next year. The people in the UP are wonderful. I had many people come up to me when I would be doing an event and say, we are so glad that somebody put all this together. We've heard about the shipwreck, but there are so many more pieces to it. And to have that all gathered into one book really made me feel good to get those kind of compliments. The book has been well received, and we're just proud to get that kind of response.
So what kind of places are selling the book for you as you go out there and tour?
Well, there are a lot of bookstores, like on the Mackinac Island, there's two bookstores. There's bookstores throughout Michigan. I just sent a batch of books over to Duluth, Minnesota, the bookstore that's located in the old Fitgers Brewery there. So that's one place. Some of the bookstores in the area are carrying them. But also, they're very popular in places like the places where tourists would visit. They're very popular in museums, history museums. And one of the things that I didn't realize when I started out doing the book is it's become a very popular book with the antique auto collectors because, in fact, it is a story about some antique autos that were rescued and that had an interesting story as to how it was done. So my book is in several of the automobile museum gift stores. You just never know where it's going to pop up. And I've had stores that have called me and said, hey, we're out of books. We need some more. So up in the Upper Peninsula, it's been well received. But for whatever reason, I'm getting requests from all over the country, Ohio, New York. I've gotten several requests from New York. The word is getting out about the book, and it's really a pleasure to find that people are interested in this story, because I'll be honest, guys, I became addicted to the story and truly fell in love with the research and writing what I had found.
I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's history, and there's just a lot of people that really like history.
Well, that's true, and when you can find something that has that much interest by so many different types of people. I mean, from people that visit the areas that I've talked about, the tourists, the travelers who want to know more about the area, to people who have lived there, whether they live there now or have lived there in the past, that want that story told to them, the complete story. It's amazing, and we've really enjoyed doing it.
Yeah. Now, you took a little bit of an alternative route from what a lot of our listeners normally do. Basically, with Shipwreck, you are the publisher and you are the distributor. You do not have any distribution at all. You can't find the book on Amazon. You're working with a print shop. I mean, are you liking that kind of arrangement? How's that working for you?
Well, so far it's working well, and I think the reason is I've been fortunate, you know, to have a very talented lady who handles putting it all together for me. So when it goes to the printer, it's ready. You know, she's done many books. I send her my copy. I send her my photos. You know, and I say, see what you can do with this for this chapter. And it's amazing what she's created. So that's made it a stressless sort of existence for me. I realize there's probably maybe a better way to do this, because I am the author, the marketing department, the shipping department, you know, you name it. If it's got to be done, I'm doing it. And it's time to look at maybe a better way to do this.
Yeah, and listeners, we have been talking about working with Fresh Ink Group, and I think we're probably going to have something worked out soon. But in the meantime, right now, if you want to find Shipwreck Book, the best place is your website. Or catch Larry out there on tour and approach him yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Larry, what's this about the Louisiana ghost story?
Yeah. Well, that was my first attempt at really doing a book, and it goes back to when I was in radio television in Louisiana. I learned about a town, and I visited it, called Hot Wells. Hot Wells was kind of like Hot Springs, Arkansas. It had been discovered when they were drilling for oil, and instead they struck this gusher of hot mineral water that turned out to have, properties to it. So this town sort of evolved around a health resort, and it became a very popular town. When I first became aware of it, our press club used to have regular meetings out there at one of the restaurants, and I was just fascinated by it. Well, I go on with my life, and many decades later end up back in Louisiana, and I go out there, and the town is all but gone for many reasons, which we talk about in the book, and it has become close to being a ghost town. But the history to it, it went from a great resort town with motels and entertainment centers to basically nearly a ghost town. There are still some people living there. Well, so I decided this story needs to be captured. I need to write about it. So I did. I, again, got into research, and I found out a lot of political history involved in it, and why it died, why it grew, and why it died. And the interesting thing, since I've been up here in Wisconsin, I've gotten an email from a friend in Louisiana that says the land, the main land in that ghost town has been purchased by an individual that is planning to create an attraction there. So we may have a sequel to the book called, you know, A Louisiana Ghost, Hot Wells, A Louisiana Ghost. And that book basically is out of print right now. There's a few left. But we may have a sequel coming up once I get back to Louisiana and see what's going on with this new enterprise at Hot Wells. It was an amazing story, and it has a lot of interesting names in it of people that were famous in Louisiana politics. I'll just give you one. The opening chapter of the book says, Governor Jimmy Davis once said, Hot Wells will be to Louisiana what Hot Springs is to Arkansas. Didn't make it. But anyhow, that was the optimism. So it was something just an old news dog felt needed to be done, so I did it.
Yeah, there you go. Now over on Twitter, Verwayne Greenhoe's got one more comment. He says, one last bit of history. The only year America never made the cent was 1815 due to the copper shortage because Britain was withholding copper. We didn't know the Upper Peninsula was lousy with the stuff. Boy, it is, too.
Well, the Native Americans knew it was up there because they were mining it long before that. They were mining it out on, when I say mining, you know, it was strictly hand digging it up, but they were out on Isle Royal. They were making tools to work with out of copper decades before it ever became a mining operation.
Yeah, definitely. Now, Larry, one of the nice things about going out and touring like you did to promote your book is you get to meet the fans. You get to talk to the people and get some feedback and stuff. I'm hoping someday to get out and meet both of my fans wherever they are out there across the country somewhere. But I just got to figure out where they are. But is it fun meeting the fans? I mean, what kind of feedback are you getting from them? You're hearing some stories back? You're getting some good reactions to the book? What are you hearing?
No, it's great to meet them because you can't, you know, you can sit at the computer and do wonderful things all day. But when somebody comes up and shakes your hand and says, I read your book or I heard about your book, and do you know that my great uncle or my whatever was involved. He drove one of those cars or I had a good story is the granddaughter of the family that basically saved the crew that took them in. I was able to meet with her and she provided me with information and some things that are in the book. So to get out and meet with the people, you get ideas. I'm, you know, that old what's my next book thing. I'm going to have to sort out some of these ideas that people have brought to me. And they sincerely mean it. They say, you should be interested in this. You know, we appreciate what you've done. Take a look at this. So it's wonderful to have people respond. You know, writers write, painters paint, and they hope somebody is paying attention. And when you go out and meet with them, by golly, you find out they're there.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, well, what sort of advice do you have for other authors that are maybe looking at writing something similar to what you wrote, or maybe not, just, you know, wanting to write something?
Yeah, well, I think the only advice I could give is on nonfiction, because if I had to write a novel, I'd be a long time trying to put that together. So with nonfiction, I think, you know, first of all, something you're interested in, it'll motivate you, but then don't be limited. It's just because you think you're interested in it, look around you and see now who else might be interested in this. You know, if you're going to write a story about your grandfather, well, was he an interesting enough person that other people would like to read about him? Or do you get lucky and write about something like Coca-Cola, which, you know, has taken me to places I never dreamed of when I wrote the book. In fact, that book turned out because I was going to do a travel feature on two of the sites that are mentioned in the book. I was just going to do a freelance travel feature, and again, it's a case of I just got involved in the story and realized because of a couple people who came to me and said, do you know about this? This is all over the country, what you're doing. And that, so you really, to a writer who writes nonfiction, number one, make sure you enjoy what you're writing about. And number two, hope that what you're writing about, a lot of other people will enjoy too. It's so rewarding.
Yeah, perfect. So, Larry, how do people find you? This is Larry Jorgensen, journalist, author, shipwreck aficionado, historian, and all around Renaissance man. How do people find you? First, let's start with the website. Where do they find this book?
Well, we've got two websites, and on both of them, we cross over with the two different types of books. So the shipwreck one is easy to remember. It's simply shipwreckedandrescued.com. And same thing with the Coca-Cola website. Easy to remember. It's simply thecoca-colatrail.com. And you get on there and you'll find out, how to reach us through the website. Now, if you want an email address, and it is on the websites, but my email address is GL, like George Little, glmanagement40@gmail.com. And yes, I will accept a phone call. If you want to spend used to be a dime, but anyhow, if you want to call, it's 337-591-1937. It's a cell phone with a Louisiana number. And I love to talk to people because that's where you get ideas.
Great. Do you have any social media like Facebook or Twitter or any of that?
I'm on Facebook. I'm not on Twitter, although I need to get back on there. But I'm not on as much of that as I should be. And maybe if I get some help with this book, maybe with my next book, maybe I'll have more time to do the social marketing as well. Because
okay.
I do enjoy it when I'm on there.
So on Facebook, you would be Larry Jorgensen. Is that what they look for?
That's correct. That's what it would be.
Okay. And listeners, as always, any of our guests, if you're trying to track them down, get a message to them, serve a warrant, whatever, we have a contact form at freshinkgroup.com. Just go there, send us a note. We will make sure we connect you with our guests because we've got some great authors, some good guests, and sometimes people actually want to talk to these people. So, Larry, it's been great having you on. Fascinating books, fascinating topics. It sounds like we're going to have an opportunity for Fresh Ink Group to be more involved in these as well, so we're looking forward to that.
We're looking forward to it, too, and hopefully we can create some more things that your listeners will want to know about.
Yeah, definitely. So, listeners, next week we're going to have Marlena Smith-Burris on the show, and what's happening after that, Beam?
After that, we had Caleb Pirtle III, a very popular episode. His wife, Linda Pirtle, is going to join us after that, a couple weeks after that. Then after that...
After that, we're going to have a pre-recorded show because that particular night we're going to be traveling. I think both of us are. And we've got a guest who's in Cornwall, England, an old friend of Fresh Ink Group and both of us, Harmony Kent. So we're going to pre-record a show with her and have that for you that night.
And after that, we have a dear friend of the show, Jan Sykes, an author out of Texas. She'll be on after that.
Yeah. And previously we had the guest, Marcia Fox. She was on about a year ago. She's got a new book. And her co-author, Pete Rising Sun, Native American, he's going to be on with her. So Marcia Fox with Pete Rising Sun will be on the week after that.
And after that, we've got, I believe, Southern California author Avante Sendre. Don't know much about her, but she's got some, I believe, some bestseller, USA Today bestsellers. So she should be an interesting interview.
Yeah, and we don't have an exact date yet, but we're looking at sometime in November, Stacy Troilo, somebody we've really been looking forward to trying to get on the show, and I think we might actually have her this time. You think so, Beam?
I think so. It's probably going to be sometime in November. She, I believe, just made a move from her home base to another state. So I think once things, the dust kind of settles there, we'll have her on, and I'm thinking November. So.
Yeah.
We'll know more
okay.
next week.
Listeners, this week's books you want to pay attention to, Shipwrecked and Rescued by Larry Jorgensen, The Coca-Cola Trail, and Return to the Coca-Cola Trail, both also by Larry Jorgensen. If you want to get a hold of him, send us a note, check out his websites, and we really appreciate you being on the show today, Larry.
Thanks for joining us,
Larry.
Well,
thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
This was a fun time.
Yep. Listeners, we'll see you next week. Thanks, everybody, for calling in and participating on Twitter, and help us spread the word.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com, and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.